Welcome to Our Future Skies in partnership with AIG. I'm John Strickland. This is a podcast where we gaze into our crystal ball, we peer through the mists, and we look at what the future may hold for the airline business. The industry has always been subject to shocks and upheavals, whether natural or man-made, and that's certainly the case now, and I don't see it changing in the coming years either. One massive challenge that the industry is wrestling with is that, of course, of sustainability, and that's one which is not going to go away. With this in mind, where can we imagine that the industry might be in a 10 to 20 year time frame? What factors and influences are going to shape its trajectory? Well, to get answers and informed perspectives on this, I'm talking with industry leaders, drawing on their deep knowledge and bringing their thinking to our podcast. In this episode, we're going to hear from a widely experienced airline leader who began his career in his native Ireland at Aer Lingus, before moving to the other side of the world where he joined Ansett Australia. He subsequently joined Qantas, where he came to lead the group's long-haul, low-cost airline Jetstar, and ultimately Qantas itself, leaving that airline in 2023. In my personal view, he's left the airline with some important legacies, which I believe will strengthen its performance for the future. So with that said, I'd like to introduce my guest today, Alan Joyce. Welcome to Our Future Skies, Alan.
John, good to talk to you again, and I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Great, me too. Well, let's start off with reflecting a little bit. I said it's a forward-looking podcast. Let's reflect a little bit backward, up to date, for you and your career. You've had a long and interesting career so far, Alan. What would you say for you have been your highlights and perhaps key points of reflection as we speak today?
Yeah, John, I suppose the career, as you said, started in Ireland working in Aer Lingus. And that was probably a highlight because Aer Lingus, when you think of the people that came out of Aer Lingus at the time, people like Conor McCarthy, who helped set up Air Asia, people like Willie Walsh, who were there, who went on to run British Airways and then now IATA. And, you know, even Tony Ryan, who left Aer Lingus and then set up a leasing company and established a leasing business and then set up Ryanair. You know, what an amazing legacy that Aer Lingus management structure had and gave us all a phenomenal training to go around the globe. And then probably the personal highlight of my career would be the establishment of Jetstar. We had the position in Australia where we thought we were going to go the exact same way as every legacy carrier around the globe. We thought that Virgin coming in as the low-cost carrier at the time was going to eat our lunch and dominate the short-haul market. And it's a very big short-haul market in Australia, as you know, John. Melbourne, Sydney is the second largest city pair in the world. So it was a potential market right for a low-cost carrier. And we had the job of setting up Jetstar and had to do it very fast. And I was the founding CEO of Jetstar with an amazing team of people that have gone on to do a huge amount in other companies in Australia and around the world. And then we had the job of coming in 5% under the cost base of Virgin. And we knew all the failures of low-cost carriers around the world, the fact that people hadn't come in with the right cost base, hadn't come in with the right separation from the legacy carrier. And we managed to do that back in 2004. And you look at the success of Jetstar now, you know, one of the largest low-cost carriers in the region, over 100 aircraft. It's carried 300 million people. It's democratized air travel. It brought airfares dramatically down in Australia. And it's one of the big success stories and one of the big foundations in the Qantas group. And the second highlight in Qantas, I would say, is probably something that's still to come. It's Project Sunrise. Challenging the aircraft manufacturers to produce an aircraft that had overcome the last tyranny of distance. Now, Qantas was founded, its founding CEO back in the 1920s said it was to overcome the tyranny of distance is what the airline was founded for. And there's one last tyranny of distance, which has been able to fly nonstop from Europe, from London into Sydney, and from the east coast of the United States into Sydney, Melbourne, and the east coast of Australia. And now that's only a couple of years away, which I think was going to be a big legacy for that airline.
Very interesting, Alan. I mean, I'd never really thought of it that way. The number of people, as you could say, were spawned by Aer Lingus. You know, this airline definitely punching above its weight in terms of almost like being a university of future airline management around the world today. And not just airline management, but the whole sector, as you described there. And your highlights there are definitely things we're going, you will not be surprised we're going to come back to as we look to the future as well. Let me just ask you something more broadly now, Alan. I mean, obviously you spent a lot of time, you're still living in Australia, you know about that market. Let's look at that, the Australasian and Asian market more broadly. Obviously you talked about some of the big markets domestically between Australian cities, but distances in Australia itself are great. Population is dispersed. New Zealand, also a remote country. Asia is the closest continent to both those countries. How would you see these markets developing in the future in terms of dynamics, you know, size and motivations for travel and so on?
Yeah, it's fascinating in Australia because Australians probably have one of the highest propensities to travel of any nation in the world. And because it's such a large distance away from everywhere, the premium market is actually, a lot of it is leisure premium market. So Qantas, I think, has over 60% of its premium cabins filled by leisure, high-end premium leisure travel. So that's good for the airline in a lot of ways that's really related to the wealth of the country. It's related to people wanting to travel overseas to visit relatives and go on holidays. And I think the other thing is the population. Like the entire history of Australia, it's been founded on immigration, and there's huge growth continuing to happen in the population. There's also a dynamic that there isn't the surface transport that there is in the rest of the world, particularly like there is in Europe. So you've got this dependency on aviation, which means that in a small country of 25 million people, you've got some of the largest city pairs in the world. You know, Qantas Group on Melbourne Sydney has over 55 flights a day. It's the second largest city pair in the world. I think Sydney Brisbane is the eighth largest city pair in the world. That's an amazing dynamic, and that propensity to travel just keeps on growing and growing. And I think with the influx of the Jetstar low airfares, that even stimulate that market more so. I think Jetstar's customers, a large element of them, had never flown before. So there's still huge potential growth, I think, in the region. And there's huge growth that can be stimulated both in the premium end and the low end. And I think what Qantas discovered when it created Jetstar is that there is these two markets, and it managed to invest in both of them. So the Qantas product domestically is one of the most super premium product in the world. Qantas has three tiers of lounges domestically, an amazing frequent flyer program. It has an amazing network. It has an amazing product. It's all bundled. It's not debundled like other legacy carriers around the world. And it created a low-cost carrier, and that's one of the lowest cost base in the region, if not the lowest, which has been able to make money on very low airfares. So there is growth in every segment of the market that has huge potential. You've also got the dynamic of living right next to one of the biggest growth markets and the biggest growth in economies in the world. And I think technology is also going to help the airlines with this in the region, because getting from Australia into Asia, into these city pairs, was really hard. You had to go through the hubs before. Now, with the introduction of narrow bodies with the range, you've got a huge opportunity for massive growth in network all the way across the Asia Pacific region that we haven't seen before. And I'm a big fan of aircraft like the A321XLR aircraft, which I think will change the dynamic of those potential growth opportunities for markets like Australia and New Zealand.
No, fascinating stuff, Alan. And I remember the first time I traveled to Australia myself and being on the flight from Sydney, I think, to Singapore. And about 4 hours into the flight, I think the captain came back for a walk around. And I remember saying to him, you know, where are we now? He said, well, we haven't left Australia. You know,
Yeah.
across 4 hours of flying, still in the continent, so dramatic distances. Do you think there might be any kind of consolidation in that part of the world? I'm thinking between Australia and New Zealand, or are they just too culturally different and separate? Is there too much national identity at stake that that wouldn't happen? They can plough their own separate furrows as they do today.
I think you've got a lot of investment in the brands. I think it's probably back where Europe was 20, 30 years ago. If you think of how nationalistic people felt about British Airways, about Lufthansa, about the major brands in the region, I think you've got that passion for Qantas and Air New Zealand. and other brands in the region that make it very hard for that to happen, John. I think what happened in Europe was there was a creation of a single market first. There was also the removal of governments from investment in the airlines, and the investment rules were then managed, and that allowed for a lot more consolidation to happen. And then you got things like, I suppose, in the case of a lot of the airlines, they were either going to go bust or they were going to consolidate. And that changed the whole dynamic as a consequence because there wasn't government bailout money. I think you probably have to have the same dynamic, maybe in the Asian markets, in the Asia Pacific markets, with governments not being as involved and heavy in the airlines, the markets fully liberating, and then government involvement being eliminated for those type of consolidations that you've seen in Europe and North America to occur. And we're probably a good bit away from that in the region, because I don't see the progression to those single markets and the lack of government involvement taking place anytime soon.
Now, interesting to watch how that may evolve in the coming decades. Let's come back to airline business models, Alan, that you alluded to in terms of your opening comments and career highlights. Obviously, models are evolving all the time, and as you said, Jetstar was one of the first long-haul low-cost airlines, which, just to say again briefly for any listeners who are not familiar, is really an emulation of short-haul low-cost, offering people low prices to go long distances and hopefully make money. But it's proved a really challenging model, generally speaking, around the world. We've had a road littered with failures so far, and indeed there are airlines that I can think of today who I wonder how long they may last in this model. But Jetstar has been incredibly successful. What do you think has been the key to the success of Jetstar, and are there lessons to learn for long haul low cost in the future that could turn the model from being one that's not just popular with passengers, but one that is profitable too?
Yeah, I think there were probably a couple of factors that worked for Jetstar's favor on that. First of all, John, I think we had a lot of leisure markets. You talk about Australia's distance from everywhere. There were a lot of leisure markets, very high volume leisure markets that are very long distances. And the one in particular that's very big was Bali. Which meant that Jetstar could put on long haul services at very low airfares with high levels of utilization overnight in flying aircraft overnight that kept the airfares very low, and there was a huge population that wanted to do it. And it was a market that carriers like Qantas struggled with because having a big premium cabin on it, which Qantas needs for its big business routes, didn't work. And I think a lot of airlines experience the same dynamic. I know a lot of the American airlines would have potentially big premium markets and then very high leisure content markets. So if you can get that separation right, which Qantas did, say these are clearly long haul markets that Qantas works on, and these are clearly long haul markets that a model like Jetstar would work on, and make that work. Which Qantas did very well. The other thing that happened with Jetstar is it was able to make a penetration in the Japanese market by setting up a short haul carrier as well. So the way I think it worked very effectively is having the short haul presence in both of the markets in Japan and in Australia, and then the long haul between the two markets worked very effectively because you had your own distribution in both markets, which is also a very hard part of the long haul leisure market. Bali was over nearly 100% Australians going out, so Jetstar had that distribution. Japan needs the distribution from Japan and Australia to work. And because Jetstar had a presence in both of them, we got that working. So that was a critical criteria, I think, to make that model work. And I think if you can find that secret sauce and keep your costs, the basics of low-cost flying are still the same. Your costs have to be extremely low, your density has to be extremely high, and you charge for the add-ons. And there's more opportunity in long-haul markets to charge for add-ons, which makes the profitability work.
I mean, it's interesting because you described there about ultra popular holiday destinations like Bali for Australians, obviously the Japanese, although we've seen a bit more reserved since COVID, have been prolific travelers. We know again about VFR traffic, visit friends and relations traffic,
Yes.
in some parts of the world is very important. And I wonder, if that's also going to be an important factor for the future, a key factor for the future, because over in this side of the world, where I'm sitting now, airlines, almost salivate at the prospect of getting onto the transatlantic, North Atlantic market. And that's one which I often describe as being potentially highly profitable and lucrative in the summer months, but you can die 1,000 deaths in the winter. And that's where we've seen long haul low cost not adhere successfully. Is it going to be a market dependent story of success? Because transatlantic, I've just mentioned, has been a tough one. We've had Peter Elbers on the series, who's now running Indigo. And they've just ordered some long haul aircraft. And again, the Indian market from a VFR basis looks like one that can possibly absorb this model for the future to certain parts of the globe.
Yeah, it's a great point, John, because that's the other dynamic that you do have to get right, which is that seasonality. And Jetstar had that, and I think all the long-haul low-cost carriers have the seasonality, where there are certain times of the year where you make all your money, and there are other times of the year where you can lose that and then some if you're not careful. And so it's then how do you minimize the losses in the non-peak periods and maximize your profits in the peak periods? That's also a key part of doing that. And a lot of that is back to scheduling. A lot of it is back to how you do maintenance. A lot of it back is the simple getting the planning right on it. And airlines that mess that up. There was also this dynamic, I suppose. Everybody always thought there was a secret sauce. The amount of times that I've had a North European a European carrier approach the Australian carrier and say, we must be counter-cyclical. Can we not move aircraft between the two as a way of solving that problem? And bizarrely, it doesn't work because some of the biggest peak periods in Australia around school holidays, which are also in July and in September, the biggest peak of the year is Christmas and New Year,
Yes.
but it's too short to move aircraft around. So everybody has their own seasonality and they're not uniquely the same. And you just have to manage them as effectively as you can to minimize those losses in tough periods of time. And I think Jetstar is very good at doing that. I know Ryanair are exceptionally good at doing that up in Europe and the short haul markets. And I'm sure if you could do it on short haul, you absolutely can do it on long haul.
No, it's certainly the challenge that vexes airline management day in, day out. And then turning to the other point that you mentioned in your opening comments, Alan, about the other model, which sounds similar to maybe somebody who's less familiar, ultra long haul. But ultra long haul, of course, is quite different. It's not about filling the plane up with very price sensitive traffic, maybe leisure traffic, but you're going to have to pay more for it. And I think it was an interesting way you described the evolution of travel to Australia. It made me reflect. I don't even remember how long it took when that tyranny of distance was first tackled. I mean, it was weeks, wasn't it? It was weeks to fly between Australia and UK and Europe on these old biplanes that stopped in empire outposts, and you didn't even know if you're going to get there with the aircraft reliability. And now, in the last few years, thanks to Qantas, you can fly non-stop from Perth to London in about 17 hours. And the aim to introduce the East Coast with this Project Sunrise that you introduced. I mean, tell us more about this model, the dynamics of that, and how it may play out for the future.
Yeah, it's a great piece of history, John, as you alluded to. I always remember that the history started with Qantas doing a partnership just after the Great Wall Street Crash in the 1920s. So in the 1930s, formed a partnership with British Empire Airways,
Right.
and it was Qantas flew to Singapore and British Empire Airways flew the rest of the way. And it was a couple of weeks, as you said. I think it was seven stops. You overnighted in a couple of spots on the way. And I always remember when we started the Perth London flight nonstop, the first time the two continents were connected directly. And we could do that with a 787. Richard Quest of CNN decided he would do that flight in one direction, but dressed up and did the flight as if it was the 1930s in the other direction. I did a piece on CNN that went all the way through what experience would have been like in the 1930s, 1940s. And it was some experience. And then I think over time, the stops became less, the seven stops became three, became two. And Qantas did have a big network when it was two or three stops. You know, it flew to places like Rome, Budapest. It flew to Frankfurt. It flew to an amazing network in Europe. But when it became the technology became such you could do it in one stop, Qantas then got eliminated from a lot of those markets by the hub carriers because it was impossible to make money against the hub carrier when you were flying. You had no traffic rights in the hub or very little. You could potentially pick up the traffic there, but you couldn't establish a base there in a lot of cases. And that's when you had the Singapores, the Thai Airways, and then the next phase, the Middle Eastern carriers dominating those markets and making a lot of money. And you look at the Emirates network today, where they have over 40 points in Europe, and they can feed, they call it the Noah's Ark of traffic. You can feed two passengers from Brisbane to Dublin through the hub. And there's enough of the two passengers from all of those places all over the world to make that network work. And of course, Qantas could never make a Brisbane Dublin work because it would never have those feed and that traffic. Then things changed because when the 787 became available, Qantas then said, let's give her a go because we were in a position where the international business was underperforming, wasn't making money. There was even, you know, at different times we talked about closing it down, selling her off, merging with other airlines. We looked at merging with British Airways, Malaysia. We looked at lots of different ways to fix the problem. And then technology came to the forefront and solved the problem. Because Perth to London, which was the first trial of it, overnight became the most profitable route in Qantas's international network and the route with the highest satisfaction. So how did Qantas do it? Well, it specialized in ultra long haul flying. It said, we're going to put less seats on this aircraft. We're going to make the product better. We're going to specialize in working with scientists in minimizing the impact of jet lag and that tyranny of distance on the customers on those flights, and work with getting the most amazing lounges along the journey. And it got its customer satisfaction up, its premium up for flying direct. And so it's a significant premium. And then the economics worked, and it was something else nobody else could do. And then once that worked, routes like flying to Dallas and nonstop, Auckland, New York, now Perth to Rome, Perth to Paris, made that network even bigger. But there was still a huge market that was missing. And that's when Qantas challenged Airbus and Boeing. I think I wrote a note to both CEOs saying, you don't have an aircraft today, but you could produce an aircraft that could do this. And we want to go for our Project Sunrise was a challenge to do it. Both of them got very excited about doing it. Both of them raised their game. Airbus, in particular, changed the A350-1000 to make it a ULO aircraft with an extra fuel tank and using the Rolls-Royce engines at the full power rates that they could be certified to give us the range to be able to do it, and won the competition. And as part of that, Qantas is putting like 100 less seats on the A350-1000 than carriers like Cathay and Qatar have on the same aircraft. But it's a huge premium configuration with massive first class cabins, big business class in total, and a premium economy with a very small economy section. But economy section has big sea pitch and an exercise area for people to travel on it because it knows it can demand a premium on those ultra long haul flights that more than covers the cost, and allows Qantas to have a unique value proposition that no other airline in the world can copy. Because Qantas has so many routes away from Australia that are in that 19, 20, 2 hour category, it can have 12 aircraft, maybe one day 24 aircraft that does this. British Airways maybe have one route on their network, that's to Sydney. American Airlines may have one route, New York to Sydney. Why would they buy a couple of
All
special
these aircraft,
aircraft
yeah.
to that? So it's a very unique proposition that Qantas looks like it'll have to itself. And a unique proposition that could be very profitable, and a unique proposition that the customers are looking like they want in droves.
I mean, this model, I mean, it has to be very carefully worked out, doesn't it, Alan? Because just to maybe give a bit of flavour for some listeners who may be less familiar. Of course, if you fly an aircraft between Australia and London or vice versa, it takes about 3 days. Now, in 3 days, BA could go across the Atlantic three times, or Qantas could go out to Asia and back three times. It's a kind of an opportunity cost in economic terms. Do I do these three trips, and what money do I make on that against the cost that I incur, or do I do one trip over 3 days, and what revenue does that generate? Which is why it has to be premium. But not only that, but the aircraft time is one thing, but because of these very long flights, you need extra crew, and they need extra rest time both in the trip and after the trip. So it's really got to have a clear balance to show that it can deliver.
Yeah, and it does come down, you're right. There's a lot of unique costs involved in it, John, that make it an expensive operation. But given the premium demand that you do have for an operation like this, the yield premium that you get for it more than covers those costs. And we've seen that with the Perth Londons and the other long hauls. The other advantage is that bizarrely, it does, while you do carry fuel to burn fuel, it does save you, and the environmental impacts on it, which is I think people have missed, are less than having to stop on the way to London, because you do have all of that infrastructure that's developed for those stops. You do have the environmental impact on that, and you do burn more fuel landing and taking off
Yeah,
than you
descending and
do.
climbing out.
Yeah, so there's a bit of a saving on that as well that's there. But the other side of this, I think, for airlines, you do have to have a look at your portfolio of assets. And Qantas has a number of other businesses that are extremely profitable, but the international part of the business is a critical part of supporting them. And it doesn't come through in the numbers sometimes. Like the loyalty business in Qantas makes nearly $500 million a year, selling points to credit card companies and Woolworths. And it's hugely stable. It's the panacea for airlines because it's a stable income that comes in, and it takes you out of the boom and bust that's there. But where do people want to use their points? They want to use it on these super long haul flights. That's the huge desire. So not only do you need to do it from an economic point of view as a standalone to help that business, but it's also a key part of supporting the domestic business. Because again, if you're out trying to get a corporate contract, and you have this unique value proposition that I can fly you to London for your board meetings or your businesses there, and I can fly you direct to New York, you're going to get the domestic business for those guys as well. So for a lot of long-haul carriers, there's also this leverage of using that business to actually enhance other businesses in your portfolio that give you the profitability. And sometimes that's not accounted on the route profitability, but it's a key part of how an airline should be making money and looking at the profitability of the airline.
When you were describing this model, Alan, I don't know if you've seen it, but there's some one of these humorous kind of poster things you get on social media, and it shows a couple traveling in the glory days of aviation, maybe the 40s and 50s, in some luxury first class cabin with an enormous buffet of food around them, and one of them saying to the other one, "Just think what air travel's going to be like, how much better it's going to be in 50 years' time." And it's got a picture of 50 years forward, and there's like a packet of crisps. And I thought, well, we talk about the dumbing down of aviation, or a bit of a price-driven travel, but people want to go on what they can afford more than anything. But this is completely the opposite with that premium service. And I haven't, as we speak, yet done that ultra-long haul, but I've got a couple of friends who've sent me pictures, and certainly it's back to the glory days of comfort when you describe the mix of cabin, and even in economy, more space, and the kind of food and stuff that is offered.
And it's an interesting one, John, because you think you're trying to get you are moving it back up market in order to attract that premium as well. And I think the first class product that Qantas will have will be a seat and a bed, as an example, which it's never done before. And the business class will have a closed door, which it's never done before. So it can invest in those products, and they're the hero products. There's what make you a premium airline that people associate with high quality. It's the equivalent of maybe the 7 Series on the BMW or the Rolls-Royce Phantom, whatever it is. It's that that equivalent product that you have to have out there if you want to be a premium airline. The other thing I think you said, which is very important, is how we forget how the dynamic of pricing changed. Because I always remember these statistics. When you were flying from Sydney to London back in 1947, Qantas did it the full way, it was 120 weeks of an average person's salary
Wow.
equivalent. And today, you know, if you're a week of an average person's salary to go for it. And I think even when we put Jets on it, the 707, it was 22 weeks of an average person's salary. You know, and you think the average salary, I think in Australia is $65,000. So that was the equivalent of nearly $30,000 for the airfare to go to London. Now, the airfares have come down dramatically as a result of that, but then the product did spec down. And there are people that are willing to pay a lot for first class and business class. And at the same time, you can still have these very inexpensive economy airfares that connect families around the world. And that's an amazing achievement that aviation's been able to do. What other product out there has come down by so much over its decades in terms of its actual price? I think aviation has achieved a lot in that space, and hasn't become the exclusivity of the very wealthy.
No, absolutely, a very important philosophical and societal point for the future, I believe, Alan. Just you touched on it as we talked about that model, another airline and how their model works through hubbing through Dubai, and that's another quality airline, Emirates. And we've had Tim Clark on the series before, and certainly he's someone who I would describe as a personally as a visionary of the industry, and certainly he was the brains behind Emirates development right from the outset, and he's still there leading it. You and he set up this partnership between Emirates and Qantas, which is still in place. It's just been recently renewed, I think, for another 5 years. That was, I think, at its time, quite a game-changing partnership, and allowed incredible use of the dynamics, the different dynamics of Qantas and Emirates to play to their strengths, as you described. It maybe sounds odd, but Qantas could pull back on a lot of these more minor European points and actually focus far more on Asian development, look to new ideas of the kind we were just talking about with ultra long haul. And Emirates could use your strength in Australia and Australasia to top up even more traffic via Dubai into Europe. Do you see that type of model continuing into the future and being used more widely than the one that has been put in place?
Yeah, I do, John. I think I agree with you, everything you said about Tim Clark. I think he was phenomenal in what he's done in Emirates and creating the powerhouse that now a lot of other people are trying to copy, and they continue to copy. And there's more of them coming. I think the Saudis seem to be trying to set up their mega airlines in the image of Emirates as well. So Tim's been phenomenal in doing that, and it was interesting how Tim works. Which, when we started reaching out to each other about potentially doing a partnership, he said, "Well, let's not talk about strategy, whether it's going to work or not. To me, this all always comes down to chemistry." And Emirates had the resort of Waltham Valley, a phenomenal resort in New South Wales that Tim had a big passion about. And I think he got it built and had a big involvement personally in it. So he said, "What we're going to do is get the management team, yours and mine, Alan, and we're going to spend a weekend in Waltham Valley and just get to know each other. And if the chemistry works, we can make the business work, the partnership work." And I thought that was very clever, because we, for the first few days, we just got to know each other, what the teams did. And then at the end of it, it was only the last half a day that we sit down and work out what the partnership could look like. And he says, "I think the chemistry is going to work, and I think this is going to work." And it was, because with all of these things, it's like any partnership, any relationship, you'll run into trouble, run into issues that will occur that you weren't expecting, and how do you manage them? And it would always be the relationships would be the way to resolve it. You pick up the phone, you get it resolved, and you weren't dependent on a contract and arrangement. And that made Qantas a lot more relevant in Europe than it had been in decades. It gave Qantas the Emirates network of 40 flights, 40 different destinations in Europe. It allowed Qantas to pull back from a market like Frankfurt. You can lose a hell of a lot of money on super long haul markets. Frankfurt was losing Qantas like close to $50 million a year. and I was able to work, was able to walk away from that. And it gave Emirates a big benefit because it gave Emirates Qantas's distribution out of Australia. I gave a lot of premium customers on Emirates, and I made that a profit center for Qantas at the same time. So it was a unique win-win, and everybody was happy with it. And then you could see a lot of Qantas's competitors, a lot of Emirates competitors trying to replicate the same thing because it's something that's worked really well for consumers. It's worked really well for both airlines, and it's given everybody a huge amount of choice. And I think what you're seeing out of that is Emirates have started to do the same partnerships with other people. So you've got Emirates was always organic. It was always growth in their own operation. Now they're doing a lot more in that space. And I think that's good again for consumers because I think the more you get airlines to help work together, integrate together, recognize the customer and important customers and the customer status, which across those airlines, the better it is for the customer. And you're seeing that happening more and more in and outside of alliances. I've never been a big believer that you have to stick within the alliance. I don't think that works because sometimes there's a carrier outside the alliance that's better for the airline. And you have to have that flexibility, which is what Qantas has done and what Emirates is doing and what other airlines now are doing across alliances.
No, I mean, really interesting stuff, Alan. And I think Emirates, as well as an airline, sometime Tim is going to stand down.
Yes.
Nobody can predict when. He's still sort of firing on all cylinders. But there's going to be an Emirates era post Sir Tim Clark. And the airline's switching direction somewhat anyway, because the large 380 aircraft will be. They're around for a good while yet, but probably till the mid 2030s, and they're getting smaller narrow bodies of the kind that Qantas has been using. So we'll probably see a shift in that airline's way of functioning as well at some point in the future.
Well, what I find is that the best airlines are the ones that can keep on reinventing
Keep
themselves.
evolving.
Yeah. And they're the ones that don't stay. And Tim is phenomenal for that. He challenges all the times. He's always trying to think about what's the next disruption, what's the stuff that can cause us a problem, and how do we evolve on it. And I think you look at what Qantas did over the last 20 years, creating Jetstar, creating super long haul travel. It's reinventing itself. And the reason why it's the oldest continuous operating airline in the world, because it keeps on reinventing itself nearly every decade. And Emirates has gone to do is doing the same.
And in terms of markets, Alan, we're talking about Australasia, we've talked about Asia. You mentioned the Saudi ambitions to grow. Emirates is an airline in the Gulf. Do you wonder if the continent that you and I both hail from, Europe, could progressively get left behind? I mean, notwithstanding what's happening short haul with dynamic airlines like Ryanair, could it get left behind?
I think what you've got in Europe is the market. Some of the markets are so massive that the airlines really specialize on them, John. You know, short haul is big, and Ryanair, the dynamic of Ryanair and what's happening there is an amazing Irish success story, I think. You know, how big has that airline become, and how big is it going to get? And it's just dominating that space. I was just in Italy on a bit of a break, and a lot of Italians think Ryanair is an Italian airline. You know, that it's
It's
so
the biggest
big.
airline in Italy,
Yeah,
isn't
isn't it? And
it?
it is amazing that it's got that penetration. And I think for the legacy carriers, you've also got this dynamic which, you know, and it all planets revolve around it, that the transatlantic in particular is so dominant. And it's where you either make your money or don't make your money. And then you've got carriers that specialize in individual markets. So I can understand that that's the case. And I think what has to happen is this continued evolution, I think. And that's going to be important. And you can see some of the airlines in Europe really focus on that evolution and what they do and where they get there. And I think as long as they keep on doing that, then those brands will always be there. But they've got a huge advantage in these huge volume markets that are very profitable. And I can understand why people want to make sure that you maximize your returns from them, because that's the way those, sometimes it's not the sexy thing that makes you the money. It's actually the day-to-day bread and butter items, like the transatlantic and like some of the short-haul markets. They're the key ones. They're not as exciting as the super long-haul travel, but they're the key to keeping your airlines profitable and successful.
And if we look again at future demand and how that's served by aircraft types, we've said a lot about aircraft already, so maybe we don't want to get too av geek, aircraft nerdy for people who are less interested. But you mentioned you believe in these narrow-bodied aircraft that can do now long flights, long-haul flights. We're seeing coming in with derivatives, particularly of Airbus aircraft. We've talked about others, but one thing I know that again, just referencing Tim Clark, he's frustrated about is we don't really see much in the way of new aircraft on the books for the coming decades. I mean, we have new versions long haul of the Boeing 777 not yet into service. There's not going to be another large aircraft like the A380. We're getting longer range capability on planes like the 320, but notwithstanding challenges in supply chain coming out of a pandemic or internal challenges at Boeing, does that concern you? Does it worry you that there isn't really innovation there in the pipeline as we get into the 2030s and beyond?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, John. I do think there's a frustration on that because I think there was a couple of opportunities missed, and you can always look back in the past. But Boeing, I always thought shouldn't have gone for the re-engining of the 737s. They were looking at a new aircraft. They were also looking at potential spaces of filling, replacing the 767 and the 757. And they had an aircraft that we thought would have been a phenomenal aircraft that they were looking at.
Was that like the new mid-market
Yeah,
aircraft at one point that it was
that's
defined
exactly
as?
right. Yeah. And it could have, for Australia, it could have been a transcontinental aircraft that could have been into Asia. It filled the gap that we thought existed in the market. And it could have been a good freight aircraft as well. But it was an aircraft that they decided the capital cost of investing in a new program was too great and he had too much going on. And then when Airbus did a re-engining of the 320s and went up with the Neos, they went down that path. Hindsight's a great thing, but it would have been better to have a new narrow body aircraft out there. And we're a bit away from that because these things, you talk about Melbourne, Sydney, and the Transatlantic being profitable. The narrow body aircraft is where these manufacturers make all the money and investing billions of dollars in new programs. You can see there's a reluctance to do that when the dynamic is such that you can make a lot of money out of the aircraft you have. And the orders, I don't think you can get a Neo until what, 2030? John, you'd know better than I would know. So the order books are full. There's not the dynamic that's needed to create a new one. And that's a pity. And I think at some stage, you want that dynamic to appear and that competitiveness to appear. And I think what's going to happen in the industry, as more and more players come into it, there's more and more. The Chinese don't have a product today, but they may have a product in a decade or in 20 years' time that challenges the European and North Americans. They're challenging the electrical car market at the moment. Could they ever challenge the aerospace market? Of course they can. And that may create the dynamic that there's a lot more innovation, there's a lot more change. Now, having said that, I think the innovation that you see in the A321 and the 220s, I mean, they are game changers and they're going to be good for the next two decades of innovation in aviation and route development and pricing because it allows you to put networks in place. Go back to the hub system that we talked about. I mean, usually when you got to certain destinations in Asia from Australia, you'd have to fly via Singapore or Bangkok or one of the big hubs, KL. Now there's going to be such an explosion of direct routes, I think, with these narrow bodies coming online, that's going to create amazing customer propositions. And the same domestically, where you'd actually have to fly through Melbourne and Sydney to connect from Perth to Maroochydore, you've got the 220, which is a very good economics that can fly 100-seater aircraft across the continent. That never happened before. So the dynamics of what these things will do is going to be phenomenal. Now, could there be more? And there's need to be more in the pipeline. Absolutely. I would share Tim's frustration on that. But I think we will eventually get there, and competition is a great thing in that space.
And just one thing linked to how we travel, what kind of aircraft, what kind of business models. The fundamental, in reality, the bedrock is demand. I mean, demand's still there. We'll touch also in a few moments on some challenges in geopolitics, but we are in a bit of a strange world in terms of maybe political outlook, but it seems to me people still wish to travel. We've seen this buoyant demand everywhere around the globe. Asia was slow to come back, but it's been coming back post pandemic. Young people, and I have quite a group of young people I speak to in the industry, they're all very energized to travel. They want to explore the world. Are you optimistic in terms of those dynamics and reasons and motivations for people still wanting to travel?
Absolutely, John. And I think when you look at it, I mean, there's been so many doomsayers over my time in aviation, probably your time in aviation, saying that this technology, emails, or it's going to impact on business travel or video conferencing. We were told that as we came out of COVID, that everybody's used to being at home doing these type of video conferencing all the time, and that was going to impact business travel dramatically. But there's always been a replacement form of travel that's filled the gap when technology, and technology's always aided aviation. I mean, a video conferencing may be a good way to initially start something, but you go back to my comment about Tim Clark wanting to make sure the chemistry worked. Lots of people know most business works on chemistry, and that you need to meet people, you need to be at the conferences. We were at that Airline Strategy Awards conference, and was it a great way for people to network and people to connect? And you couldn't do that through video conferencing, and that is always going to be there, and it's human nature to want to connect personally. And then you've got what COVID taught us, the importance of having experiences. So when we came out of COVID, we were seeing in every piece of research, people were saying they wanted to spend the money on experiences because they missed them for 2 years. And I know my nieces who were, in Victoria, they had the world's longest neck lockdown for nearly over 200 days. What they've been doing now is living life. They've been traveling around the globe, gone to Europe. One of my nieces is in Africa at the moment, and they just want to travel. And the passion has been more enhanced by what we came through on COVID. And I think that's going to be great for demand for the next few years. So and as we see the projections of demand, as more and more of the population can afford travel, as travel becomes cheaper, as airfares have been coming down, the demand for aviation and demand for travel, as you can see with aircraft orders, I think at the moment our problem is I'm not sure we're going to get enough aircraft, enough supply to meet that future demand, and hopefully Boeing can get their production levels back up so that that supply is there for that demand, because it is going to be quite massive going forward.
I mean, the demand outlook, hopefully, God willing, is a strong one. But the challenge we face alongside that, and the new aircraft coming through, as I mentioned at the beginning, of course, is sustainability. And while
Yes.
that's a topic in its own right, we could do multiple podcasts just on that subject. And I've asked other people in the industry their views about this. What is your view, Alan? Because it seems to me, my belief is people in the industry, they certainly treat it seriously. If anybody outside the industry thinks people in aviation are another breed and don't treat it seriously, I think that is incorrect. However, we are moving slowly. We talk about sustainable aviation fuels, but not getting much supply. And when I've asked people like Tim before, hopes about getting new technology engines for long haul aircraft, people such as Tim will say, not a chance as far as we can see in the next 50 years. And that gives us a very real logjam to break and a headache to overcome.
Yeah, I think it. A couple of things on that, John. I think you're absolutely right. I know in the focus of the Qantas senior management team for a long time has been what we're going to do in sustainability. It's just a big area that every airline in the world has as in its top few things it needs to have a solution to, and it is a lot of it is very long-term planning. Because I always use the story when I became CEO of Qantas in 2008, I took delivery of the first A380, and 12 of them arrived. But they were not ordered by the previous CEO, they were ordered by the CEO before that. So the
Right.
lead times in aviation, and they're going to be there. They're there for the current CEO, and they're probably going to be there for the next CEO. So the lead times in aviation are massive. And if you don't start looking at these problems now, you won't have a solution for that period of time. And the problem with, unlike cars, unlike unlike other forms of transport. As you know, John, the issue is the power to weight ratio of getting the power that's needed in jet aviation aircraft in order to move people a certain distance. And the technology will be there, I think, for short distances, the city to Wagga Wagga, the regional operations, whether it's a hybrid aircraft or it's an electrical aircraft on those small distances. It absolutely would be there. When I left Qantas, I think that the maths was telling us at the time to fly Melbourne Sydney, which is just over an hour, the batteries had to be 34 times the weight of the fuel that was being carried. And there's no battery projections that are going to get that down to a level that makes that economic anytime soon. Then you've got the issue of potentially with hydrogen and the hydrogen issue, which has come up because there's been a few big investors in Australia that are keen to put a lot of money into that space. But the big issue with hydrogen is in distribution into the aircraft and getting an aircraft. It's a complete changing of how fuel is delivered and how aircraft are constructed. And we're a good bit away from that. And that could be promising, but that's a long way away. So when you get down to it, there are only a couple of solutions to the problem today. And the biggest one is sustainable aviation fuel. And I still think there's not enough investment happening there. It's happening more with the Americans, with the IRA Act. With the Europeans, we were trying to encourage the Australian government to invest more in the space, and more is happening. But this is the space because, and the dilemma on this is that the cost is a lot higher than jet aviation. It's going to be two, three, maybe four times. And as more and more airlines want to grab the supply to meet their sustainability objectives, there's more demand than there is supply. And that means that the cost of this is not coming down as fast as it could. And I think you're going to need a lot more investment in the space to get the cost of down, to get the cost of this down rapidly, so more and more airlines can meet their commitments that they've made in most cases to be net zero by 2050. And it's all possible, but that is the only interim solution in order for us to get there. I'm also a big believer. I know a few airlines don't believe in them as carbon offsets. I think if they're the right high quality programs that are appropriately audited, they can make a difference. And for a lot of consumers, they want the option of using sustainable aviation fuel, a technology solution, or a carbon offset commitment as well. And we should be continuing there. A lot of airlines are saying they're not going to get into that space because it hadn't been as regulated in some categories as it could have been. But I think we need to, a lot of people need to revisit that and figure out how we can use that as a solution as well.
There's certainly a lot to be done, Alan. I do wonder sometimes. I mean, we could never have predicted something like COVID in the way that it grounded the industry, globally for about 2 years. We couldn't predict some of the problems, not completely induced by the pandemic, but certainly coming out of them, engine problems and so on we see right now, which are taking capacity out of the market. I wonder, as well as the hard, intense work that you describe has to be done on fuels, on technology, on investment, if there'll be these unexpected, I don't know, you could even say black swan events that are going to come in and intervene on air travel's activity over the coming decades.
When I started working at Aer Lingus, my boss, who was the head of economic planning at the time, he said, Alan, my rule of thumb for you is that roughly every 5 to 7 years, you're going to have an aviation crisis. And he was spot on. There was nearly something that happened over that period of time during your career. And so you don't know. We didn't know about COVID. We didn't know about the global financial crisis. We didn't know about a lot of those things that happened over the time, my time frame in the industry. So there is going to be a black swan event. And what the aviation industry, I think, has shown coming through COVID is how adaptable it can be. I mean, what other industry could overnight, because Qantas, I think, had 98% of its operation grounded because the borders closed both domestically and internationally. And $18 billion business. And overnight, there's no revenue coming in, but you had a huge amount of costs. And there's not many businesses around the globe that can then adapt and pivot to try and survive an environment like that. Now, are more of those things going to happen? You know, yeah, people are saying pandemics may become more common into the future. We used to say 1 in 100 year event. Some scientists are saying it could be 1 in 15 years. So it'll be maybe in our lifetime we might, I hope we don't, but we might see something
Yes,
like
we
that.
might witness it
Like
again.
that, yeah. And what you know is that the guys that adapt to it, cope with it, are flexible on their feet, make other business decisions, survive. Qantas was, selling its bar carts to customers. It was flying flights to nowhere. So it took off from Sydney, went around the harbour for those people that got sick of not being able to travel and landed again. So
That's good.
the innovation and the entrepreneurial shop, or the fact that you couldn't fly, you could only fly interstate, meant a lot of interstate routes Qantas came on and tried them out because it had aircraft, it had people, and it might as well generate some cash. So the innovation that is there when you go through a crisis, I think, can be something else. And it's not to be a deer in the headlights, frozen by it, to say, what do we need to do to get through this and what are the opportunities? Because they always create opportunities at the other end as well. And the airlines that do that are the airlines that survive and thrive.
And whatever challenges, what does your career teach you about whatever challenges it could be? Or what should airline management into the future be expecting to be challenged by?
Well, I think the fight for talent has always been a big one I had. Outside the sustainability, which we covered, the next biggest challenge that's there. And I was a big believer, John, in diversity and promoting
Yes.
diversity and inclusion, because I think we're going to be more and more fighting for the same talent in different industries. And the great thing about, I look at where Qantas came to on that, and it's now a female CEO. The CEO of Virgin, a major competitor, was one of my executives. The CEO of now Myer, big department store, was the head of loyalty in Qantas. And so you got these great women that have been promoted through the organization with its diversity and inclusion, and unbelievably capable women. And the same with the LGBTI community. We had our first openly gay CEO, I think, of an airline out there, I would have said, of a major airline. And then we have a number of LGBTI people in the senior management team. But the war areas that we underperformed on, and compared to the rest of society, like, I think aviation needs to get a lot more female pilots interested in that, get girls interested in STEM subjects at school so that they can become pilots and engineers. Because you don't want to be just fishing in 50% of the pond. You want all the best talent as pilots and engineers, and encouraging young girls to be interested in those careers, I think, is going to be key. And you look at the demand we're going to need for a lot of those technical skills going forward, it's going to be huge. And getting that diversity, that skill base right, and a lot of other industries are going to be fighting for them. And the dilemma with aviation is it does have the cycle, boom and bust, with these challenges that happen. So people then think, is that a career after COVID? Is that a career I want to get into? Because another COVID could happen, and then I'd be stood down for a year or 2 years without a job. So we need to make it attractive. We need to make sure that people are finding it as an exciting an opportunity. And doing things like Project Sunrise, doing things like new technology, doing things like sustainability, because it also intersects. Because people of this new generation want to work for an industry that they believe is socially conscious, that they believe has a minimum impact on the environment, and it's looking at what they do in the environment. And aviation needs to get those right to attract that talent. That's the other big challenge I think aviation will have.
No, and I think it's a challenge, but as you said, it's such an opportunity. I mean, I'm really happy to see the number of young people who I talk with who are incredibly keen and passionate about the industry. They see the challenges, but they want to take them on. And I would say to them, you are the future. You are the
Yes.
future of this industry, and indeed of the species, with that wider role that aviation plays in making sure we all actually meet each other and get around a planet. Just maybe one final thought, Alan, linking into that is we haven't had time to really talk a lot about technology, but obviously it's implicit. We've talked about technology and aircraft. We're in an era now of AI and automation. And where does that sit in terms of these opportunities for the future for people in the industry, for the species? Is it a positive thing there, or is it something we should be more concerned about, how technology is evolving?
I think you like everything on this one, John. You've got the opportunities and the challenges with technology like that. And I think you have to be conscious of both of them and go into it with your eyes completely opening. So on the opportunities, I mean, you think I'm a network planner, I'm a fleet planner, and you think of some of these tools and how they would have helped your life in if there's suddenly fog in Sydney, or there's fog in Brisbane, and you have to solve a massive mathematical problem, which there is, of how do you get all your customers and your aircraft back into operation as the fog goes down. Getting AI to help you with problems like that will come out with better customer solutions, more efficient solutions, or faster solutions. And we know there's so many of those in the aviation industry, given the logistics involved in it. Potentially the design of aircraft, we talked about that. You can imagine what leveraging, and I'm sure both Boeing and Airbus are doing it, leveraging AI could do in all of those spaces. There's also challenges because my niece, when she went to Europe, actually used AI to say, plan an itinerary for me going around Europe. And in that algorithm, in that space of GPT chat, it came out with airlines and places to go. So we've gone from a place where airlines were disintermediated with the GDSs to a place where a lot of people are going back to airlines directly, where there's a lot more now with the internet, a lot more transparency in what airlines fly, what routes, and what the prices are. So we just need to make sure that that continues in that right evolution and it doesn't become a black box where you're told this is the right airline to travel on that right route and not understanding what the background to that is and how that decision is made and that recommendation is made. But it's going to make people's life a lot easier, a lot more easier to travel over time. So great opportunities in that space as well. But I think we have to be conscious of both the opportunities and the threats that these create and making sure we minimize the threats and maximize the opportunities from them. And that's what people in aviation, I think, have always done.
I think that's a good philosophical point on which to end, Alan. I think we've had a good good long talk. I could talk with you more, but we better draw things to a conclusion. So, Alan Joyce, many thanks for your time.
Thanks, John. It's been a pleasure. It's really enjoyed it as well. Thank you for your time.
Looking forward to seeing your further contributions to the industry in the decades ahead.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it.
Thank you to you for listening. I'll be back soon with the next Our Future Skies episode in partnership with AIG. But for now, for me, John Strickland, goodbye.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast series are those of the speakers and do not reflect the views, policy, or position of American International Group, Inc., or its subsidiaries or affiliates, AIG. Any content provided by the speakers in this podcast series is their opinion and is not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, individual, or group of individuals, or anyone or anything. AIG makes no warranty or representations as to the accuracy, completeness, correctness, or validity of any information provided during this podcast series, and AIG will not be liable for any errors, inaccuracies, or omissions in the information provided during this podcast series, or any damages, losses, liabilities, injuries resulting from or arising from the podcast, including your use of the podcast.